Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to Pass Gas. This week, it's Dodge Part 2. We're going to be talking about the juicy stuff, stuff that we like here. Talking Hemis. Where did that come from? Well, we'll tell you. We're going to talk about the Charger Daytona. We're going to talk about NASCAR. Protectionism at the end. That's fun. All that and more on today's episode. It's Dodge Part 2. Let's get into it. On March 24th, 1970, Chrysler Corporation engineers prepped car number DC-93 to make history. DC-93 was better known as Buddy Baker's light blue Dodge Charger Daytona. The long, low, pointy, and swoopy race car idled at the line at the Alabama International Motor Speedway, now known as Talladega. Baker rode through the gears and got the winged warrior up to speed. His top speed climbed by a little each lap. Then, to the surprise of everyone but the Chrysler engineers, the car passed 200 miles per hour and maintained that speed. Baker not only smashed through the once thought impossible 200 mile per hour lap speed, but he also beat that year's pole speed at the Indianapolis 500 by more than 30 miles per hour. The press, the fans, and Monday car shoppers all went wild. The one group that didn't go wild were the NASCAR overlords who established the rules. They met after Baker broke 200 miles per hour and decided that the Charger Daytona and its Arrow ilk, the Superbird, the Torino Talladega, and the Mercury Cyclone Spoiler 2 were all too unsafe for their racetracks. This ruling was a month after the death of Dodge Daytona driver Talmadge Prince at the Daytona 500 qualifier. The aerodynamic race cars were all banned and the drivers returned to the chunkier car shapes, but Baker's record held tight until 1987. This could have been the nail in the coffin, but Dodge didn't turn their back on NASCAR. They lobbied and successfully brought Richard Petty over to their side in 1972 and watched as the king won race after race in his STP Blue Charger. How did Dodge pivot a little-known fighter plane motor into one of the most well-known engines of all time? What was the secret formula that kept Dodge dominating on American racetracks? How did Dodge spin the 1970s gas crisis into an opportunity to sell a new kind of car to the American public? We're going to find out. Today, it's Dodge Part 2 on Past Gas.
Rum, 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 rum.
That's pretty good.
I was practicing all weekend.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Damn,
I can tell.
We can tell, Joe.
Yeah.
Amazing job.
Thank you.
That yelling you hear in the background, dear listener, is Tristan in the garage. He's working on the unclapped FRS, but You're listening right now to Pass Gas. Welcome back to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Across from me today, a man so powerful, so handsome, so bearded, it could only be Justin Freeman.
Woo! You forgot my traps, but it works.
How could I forget those? And
my main quality.
Wow. That's a little peek into your psyche there. I wasn't expecting. And of course, to my left, Joe Weber.
Oh.
How you doing?
I was waiting for some qualifiers.
Number one dad.
Number one dad.
Caked up, caked up, cake boss.
Caked up. Baseball legend.
I don't know. This is probably a good thing, and maybe a good thing to admit on the podcast. I don't know if I could pick your butt out of a lineup.
Oh, oh. Dude, you'd know my dump
so?
Truck
your
from
dumpy?
Any.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, you put me up against Jimmy?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know if I should be admitting that.
Yeah. There was one time. When we released our orange cargo like carpenter pants, I walked into the office and everyone's trying to figure out whose butt it is
in the pictures.
And because it's like all you see are the pants.
Yeah.
And Christina goes, "That's definitely Justin's butt." And I was like, "Yeah, that's me."
That's really funny.
That's my ass.
Like, oh, interesting.
Today we're talking about Dodge. It's part two. We started part one last week. We got to know the Dodge brothers. We learned that they worked with Henry Ford. They
were actually one of them contractors. Was actually the vice president of Ford at one point before he was like, I'm going to leave to start a new company.
I don't think we brought up on the show, but something I did want to address in that episode, you know, there's, I think we actually said this in an old Wheelhouse episode, like 7 years ago now. You know, that maybe what part of the reason that Henry Ford didn't like the Dodge brothers, that they started having some beef, was that the Dodge brothers were Jewish. That's something that we've said on Wheelhouse.
Oh, I didn't know they were Jewish.
The old Dodge brothers logo, it looks like a Star of David. So people assume that they are in fact Jewish when they are not. I just wanted to dispel that myth. They just happen to have a logo that looks that makes them seem like they are. And Henry Ford being a noted anti-Semite, that narrative would make sense. But
it is the Star of David. That's crazy. I've never seen this logo before.
Two deltas together. Two triangles.
Because brothers. Two.
Yes.
Okay.
So they really worship the devil.
No. Yeah. Not so really. I just wanted to talk about that real quick.
That's fun.
Happy New Year, everybody. Yeah.
Happy New Year. Whoa. You guys mine was crazy.
You guys are living in the future listening to this.
By now, you've seen the Ranger finale that just released today and the Hilo finale.
That's right. Yes.
Man, good Christmas break.
Big year. Yeah. Damn. Okay.
Before we jump into Dodge Part 2 this week, let's do our Road and Snack segment. We have a special treat that Audrey didn't let me know what it is beforehand. Oh.
What is that?
Zagnut.
Zagnut? This sounds painful.
Zagnut. It's crunchy peanut butter toasted coconut.
The doctor told me I got Zagnut.
It sounds it's like testicular torsion.
Oh god.
Bro, I think I've been there.
Got the twist.
This one's really easy. Ugh, it's not good.
I think I'm gonna like this one. Zagnut. Oh, it's dry though. It looks dry as hell.
It looks very dry.
I heard good something cross about section. Coconut.
Probably can't see that on the camera over there, but it looks like
Butterfinger.
If you ever driven through the Southwest and seen the layers of rock on the side of the road, primordial rock. That's what this looks like in the cross section. Let's get a little taste.
It's pretty good.
That's delicious.
Yeah.
That's so good.
It is from Hershey. I was Hershey just reading product. That.
Weird.
From
it's
Pennsylvania.
Weird
that, that's an old style candy bar, but that is delicious.
Introduced in 1930.
Yeah, it's
this one stands the test of time.
Yeah.
Other old candy does not.
It's a mixed bag. The Abba Zaba, not good. Zagnut, that gets the Nolan J. Sykes stamp of approval. Yummy, yummy.
That's so good. I like whatever kind of toffee is in there.
Yeah, it's great. That's a good one. That's a 8 out of 10 for me.
You know what's an underrated candy bar that you see everywhere but you just never pick up?
What?
Payday.
I love Payday. Payday and Baby Ruth.
Yeah. They're just so good.
They're so good.
I don't think I've ever paid for a Payday or eaten one.
You should
try. What is the difference between Payday and Baby Ruth?
I don't know. I think the shape.
They might be competitors.
I think Baby Ruth has chocolate.
Oh, Payday doesn't. Payday
does. Yeah. One's coated in chocolate, one's not. But man.
So good.
But yes, I would rate that a 7.3.
Yeah. As far as a road trip snack, though, the one bite is enough for me. So
you're
I don't
gonna
know
get
about
all
like,
that on your. Yeah. You're going to get it all on your belly.
You're
going to
get
you know?
It on your. Yeah.
And then honestly, though, the flavor and the mouthfeel, so good.
Yeah.
It's a whole experience. You know, you're not going to eat that whole thing. In one bite.
Sure.
Yeah.
You're going to share it.
You're going to take your time because it's good.
It's good stuff.
Because of that, I think I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay.
So 8, 8, 7. That's pretty good.
That's good. Nice. Let's get into Dodge Part 2. As the dust of World War II settled and the Nazis were all rounded up, Dodge began its biggest comeback ever. They'd fully secured and dominated the truck market during World War II and were set to continue that trend. In 1945, Dodge launched the now famously named Power Wagon.
Nice. I was on Craigslist last week trying to find a reasonably priced one.
You've seen the new ones? They're huge.
Yeah.
You can find a Power Wagon in the casual encounter section. The truck was a huge success on farms and rural roads across the nation, and it debuted 3 years before Ford's F-Series. Wow.
Wow, good timing.
The beefy trucks were based directly on the 3/4-ton World War II military trucks and the first 4x4 publicly available to civilians. It was the base that most modern base model trucks were built upon. As the trucks started selling like crazy, Dodge started spinning back up their civilian car division. Their first releases after World War II were the Coronet and the Meadowbrook, which I've never heard of.
Really?
Meadowbrook looks exactly like
your car.
My car.
Yeah, that is your car.
That's an Imperial.
My great-grandmother's neighborhood was called Meadowbrook.
The money, dude. That's an Imperial. That's a freaking Imperial right there.
That is your color, too, right?
Yeah. That is my color.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You just have the limo version of this.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing.
Oh, so yours is a little bit longer wheelbase or something?
I thought it did, but then the limo actually is enormous.
Really?
Yeah. It weighs like 6,000 pounds. It's a huge truck. Car.
Practically, it's a truck.
It is almost a truck. My car, I think, weighs like 5,400 pounds.
Jeez.
That's cool. Meadowbrook. Very nice. So, much like their pre-World War II predecessors, these Dodges looked to the future and offered serious innovations. While all Dodges at the time sported a 230 cubic inch six banger that squeaked out 103 horsepower, the company offered a never-before-seen fluid-driven transmission called the Gyromatic.
Whoa.
Gyromatic is when your grandma goes to the club.
I haven't seen her this fluid in ages.
So the Gyromatic was a semi-automatic transmission where the high range would be selected using the clutch, but then all the other shifting would be handled through a series of stomping and letting off the accelerator pedal, even the driver's hands free to cuddle their significant other or wave at passersby.
Isn't that how your original transmission was?
Somewhat. Yeah. So I've got the fluid torque drive transmission originally in my car, and you use the clutch you don't use it to get going. You just use it to select high and low, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
As Dodge was once again called into service in the Korean War, the civilians' cars stagnated. But during that time, Dodge had a breakthrough that would forever change the company and the vocabulary of takeover attendees everywhere.
Got him in.
While experimenting during the sunset of the World War II war effort, Chrysler engineers were tinkering with a motor for the P-47 Thunderbolt fighter plane, which happens to not be a car so much as a small fighter plane. Their new designs were never utilized due to the war machine coming to a grinding halt as the United States dropped nuclear bombs on Japan. But they emerged from battle mode with the first trial runs of an engine using a hemispherical combustion chamber. These guys were pretty stoked.
Oh, you guys are stoked on my Hemi.
A hemispherical combustion chamber offers a lot of advantages and only one real disadvantage. For starters, the domed shape, which is matched by the piston and spark plugs, creates more surface area than traditional engine layouts, which reduces the amount of heat produced and energy that is lost. Chrysler engineers took those findings back to the civilian auto sales battlefield and developed a motor based on that same Hemi design, the overhead valve V8, dubbed the Firepower.
I love old engine names.
Because now we just have LS.
And it's like, how many letters can you smash together?
Yeah.
The first version of the Hemi had 331 cubic inches of displacement and chugged out a massive 180 horsepower.
That's a lot for the time.
Face melting.
At the time, the big dog in horsepower manufacturing marketing propaganda was the Hudson Hornet, which put out a whopping 145 horsepower out of its flathead six-cylinder to the rear tires. We talked about this a few weeks ago. This is the engine that I have in my Imperial.
Firepower.
The Firepower. Yeah,
Firepower.
It's the reason I wanted to buy the car in the first place. After doing the up to speed on Hemi a couple years ago, I was like, I got to have a car with this engine, the 331.
And the original engine from your car?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah. Three of the four Chrysler divisions knuckled down and started building their own Hemis. But they surprisingly didn't have anything in common, aside from the hemispherical heads. The now defunct DeSoto dubbed theirs Fire Dome, which sounds awesome.
That does sound cool. Mm.
Chrysler called theirs Firepower, which we already mentioned. And Dodge stayed on brand, naming theirs Red Ram. But it was referred to as a Hemi from day one.
Red Ram.
As the Red Ram debuted, Dodge, always looking to show off their performance and power, took a gaggle of Hemi-powered sedans and convertibles to the Bonneville Salt Flats. as the dust cleared, they'd set 196 new AAA certified speed records.
Wow.
With a gaggle. Yeah, what do you call your buddies? A gaggle?
Yeah.
Were you a gaggle?
Well, I would call Jimmy and his friends a gaggle of goofballs or something.
A gaggle of goofballs? Yeah.
But I can't even think of 196 records that involve just going in a straight line.
Yeah, it's strange. For real.
They just like cut weight.
Yeah.
Pulled off a couple body parts. Yeah, we're in a different class now.
Fastest three-seater car.
With four people in it. I mean, they probably got real granular with it.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now back to the show.
The true winner of the day was the Dodge Coronet, which was responsible for breaking 100 of these records on its own while having electronic windows and optional air conditioning.
So as you go over whatever the record mile an hour, does each mile an hour you go over count as a new record?
I think each run would count as a record on
its own. Each run counts as a record.
You could do that.
He did 100 runs.
It's very possible.
That's what Olympians do.
Yeah.
I actually found out this about the guy who was smashing the pole vault.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that guy. Yeah.
They were like, oh, we know he's not giving it his all because his country pays him $100,000 every time he breaks a record. So he's holding back so he can keep breaking it.
Smart.
It's really smart.
That's smart. Dodge's Little Red Ram was such a hit with auto manufacturers that Toyota snuck one to Japan and reproduced it for their 1960s full-size Century sedan. And they kept pumping out engines until the mid-80s to bolt into their top-of-the-line executive cars. That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I didn't realize that Japan made Hemis. At all. It's never been brought up.
This is a little factoid I never knew about.
One of the, like the Land Cruisers, there's the American 4.7 that's in my Tundra, but then the Land Cruiser has the Japanese 4.7 and it's like they're built differently. It's really weird.
Really?
Yeah. They have different problems, different common issues.
Is it called the Prado over there still or no?
Prado is just like a subclass of Land Cruisers, so it depends.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The Red Ram was pretty small for the time. It displaced only 241 cubic inches, just 3 cubic inches short of a full 4 liters, through using a cylinder bore just shy of 3.5 inches and a 3.25-inch stroke.
So is this over square?
It was a short stroke for the time, Joe. For example, a 337 cubic inches.
What are you trying to say?
A Ford 337 V8 from the 50s had a stroke of 4.375 inches. So that's pretty big. But this shorter stroke slowed down the pistons and extended engine life.
Ah. It's also... Yeah.
That makes sense because the red line on my car is like 5,000 RPM.
Wow, slowing down makes you last longer.
You learn something every day.
As the Red Ram aged and the passenger cars grew bigger, so did the displacement of those engines. The first version, like we said, came in around 241 cubic inches in 55, but eventually settled into 325 cubic inches for the final year, making a whopping 260 horsepower when topped off with a 4-barrel carb.
Whoa.
That's kind of the key there, because the carburetor that came on my 331 that when I first got it, was a Carter
2-barrel
carb.
Yeah.
Kind of chokes it up a little bit. Mm-hmm.
I get choked up whenever I think about your car.
Yeah, me too. My goal for next year. For this year, actually, it's 2025. Get the Imperial out of this parking lot. Get it cruising and drive it around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have an extra parking space at your house?
I do not, but I need to get permanent street parking. It'll be fine. I'm just going to street park it. Like,
yeah.
Whatever. It's all rusty and gross looking anyway. Like, what's.
It just gets towed away. This is an abandoned vehicle. It's like, no, it wasn't.
I got to register it. Yeah. I know. It's a whole thing. But. I want to drive that thing. Anyway, we just got so busy last year.
Dude. What yeah, a it's great been a year. Yeah.
It's crazy. Anyway. So yeah, made the 325 made a whopping 260 horsepower when topped off with that four barrel carb. Over at the Chrysler mothership, their much larger 392 cubic inch firepower was driving 375 horsepower to the tires of the 300C, which Dodge considered less competition, more of a goal to strive for. I mean, that's Dodge is wild. Under the Chrysler umbrella, so yeah.
But 375 horsepower in what, 1955?
That's incredible. Yeah, it's pretty gnarly.
That's nuts.
Some other cars that featured these early Hemis were the Chrysler New Yorker, starting in the 57. We had the Imperial Custom, the Crown, and the LeBaron, which are all available with a Hemi starting in 1951, not 1957. And by 1958, the Chrysler 300D was shipping with a 392 Hemi. Damn, that's sick.
As the 50s rolled into the 60s, Dodge was all in on performance. One of the greatest engines of this time was the 413 Max Wedge that they dropped into the 1964 Dodge 330 Lightweight. It featured two four-barrel carbs in diagonal configuration.
Yeah, diagonal. They're like canted, offset.
Yeah, under not, the hood. Not just like in a row.
No. Boop, more. It had to do with like the intake runners and the length of those. And they would, you know, so you have the two carburetors, they're offset. The carb on the like the left side of the engine would be feeding its air-fuel mixture to the, on the left side would be going to the right side of the engine.
Oh, this was all like left brain, right brain.
Yeah, so it was all to, you know, you can affect how torque and horsepower work with the length of your runners on your intake. Mm-hmm. So they had used math to figure out like the best length to maximize performance out of this little 413 here.
That's sick. Cool. Yeah,
that's little. That's like enormous. That's
so big. It's like an equal length intake.
Somewhat. Yeah. You can think of it like that.
Yeah.
Dodge engineers cobbled together this 330 for drag racing. It featured an aluminum hood as well as super lightweight doors, fenders, and bumpers. The final weight came in just shy of 3,300 pounds, which is a full 700 pounds below the average car weight at the time and lighter than most V8 sports cars.
But dude, you didn't even lose that in low Mustang, did you? You lost what, 300 pounds?
We lost 300 pounds, yeah.
Man, that's a lot of weight.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, dude, I mean, this thing is 413, it's still not even their biggest engine yet, and it's 6.8 liters.
Oh my god. Oh.
Massive.
And it made 410 horsepower, yeah, which is so close to 413. I'm like, you couldn't get three more horsepower and make it perfect?
We'll be right back after these messages.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now back to the show.
While the 330 Lightweight was considered one of the first true muscle cars, it wasn't until the Charger hit the showrooms in 1966 that the public was climbing on board the all-out ridiculous speed train that Dodge was prepping to unleash on the market.
Dude, these early Chargers are so sick too. They're not like, they're not, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard shape that we're used to yet, but like they have a fastback.
The fastback.
They look like mob cars. I love them. They're so cool. They're really hard to find though.
My one of my buddies in high school, his grandfather had one of these early Chargers.
That's cool.
And he did prom in it and graduation.
Oh, no kidding.
In it.
And that's sick.
It was so heavy that you had to keep putting air in the tires.
That's really funny.
It was just squeezing.
Oh, my God. Man.
Dude, I bought all of these things. God, yeah, these Chargers
beautiful.
Are so cool.
So jealous. I love
these. The first gen two door.
One of these with a freaking hurricane in there?
That would actually be really sick. The first gen two-door fastback Charger was based on the earlier Coronet and featured some design treatments that would be familiar these days, like full-width taillights and convex grills.
Yep.
The Charger boasted three V8 options, with the top dog being the 7-liter Hemi V8 that made 425 horsepower.
Jeez, and crackers.
The power hit the rear through a not entirely awful three-speed stick.
Hmm.
But the real cherry on top was that the Charger featured the first ever rear spoiler on a production car in America.
Big Wang Gang.
A little twist of a lip on the deck lid that you can see nowadays on everything from the EcoBoost Mustang to the Hyundai Ioniq 6. While the spoiler was tiny, it was just enough to create some downforce to the rear tires and push David Pearson to win the NASCAR Grand National Championship in 1966. His first Cup Series win.
Back when stock cars were stock.
In that year's NASCAR Grand National season alone, Dodge secured 18 wins and the manufacturer's title. The next year, Richard Petty won 10 races in a row with a 426 Hemi, a record that will never be broken.
Why?
Because
I think just the rule regulations make things so competitive now that, like, I don't know if any
What if someone's that good?
I think it's hard to even win like two races in a row these days. So yeah, you're right. The parity between the cars is like so close now.
Right. They're also a lot more aggressive nowadays with like hitting each other.
While the massive motors of the 1960s dominated and spread to every manufacturer, Dodge needed some new tricks up their sleeves. One that hadn't been fully explored in the NASCAR scene was the idea of extreme aerodynamics. Advanced plastics that are used nowadays weren't available yet, so the Big Three broke out some insanely big spoilers. It started with a blue oval who elongated their fastback hardtop Fairlane Cobra a bit, let it stick out its bottom lip, and dubbed it the Torino Talladega.
So basically giving it a fastback instead of having a place where the air can like create drag behind the passenger compartment, they're elongating that out. Also, you'll see like they pushed the front of the car too is a lot, like there isn't as much of a big mouth to catch air. Like the headlights are closer to the very front of the the sheet metal there. It's all to cut through the air better.
Yeah, there's not little pockets where it's creating
exactly.
Disruption.
Yes.
Up front, Ford stretched out the sheet metal a full 6 inches to brush the window side while flush mounting the grill, something that wasn't thought of until that point. The rear bumper was carved into a V to make an air dam that worked amazingly well with the overall lower ride of the race car. Ford's handling of the aerodynamic issue was pretty tame and subtle compared to what was to come. It was subtle enough that Dodge took one look, read the raw data, and said, "Game on." You think Dodge would say game on, or what would they say?
Hold on. Hold my beer, brother. So it's like that, huh?
Yeah, they are kind of salty. Dodge looked at that elongated snout on the Torino and had decided that a full-on beak would be better. Engineers crafted a full sheet metal nose that hung off the car.
So this actually kind of skips over another important part of Dodge's NASCAR history. Before the Daytona with the pointy... with the pony nose and the tail that we all know.
Duck face. They also had one. Duck face.
They literally copied, I think, the Torino with something called the Charger 500, which where they did the same thing. Instead of having that big mouth on the front, big shark mouth that the Charger has, which is awesome, like styling-wise, they did the same thing. They pushed the headlights and grill forward a bit to fill in that space so there wasn't a big mouth catching wind at the front of the car. And then one of the best parts of styling on that car, on the stock car, or sorry, the car you could buy from the factory, is kind of like the buttresses that come down from the roof to the trunk.
Yeah.
You know, there's like the rear window is kind of like sunken in a little bit. It looks really great, but it's terrible aerodynamically speaking. The faster you go, that's creating a low pressure zone and like pulling your car up. So you get really squirrely at speed. So what they did.
Would you call that a notchback?
Sort of, but not really.
Yeah.
So, yes, like that. Like, that's exactly... So, those buttresses right
it
there.
It looks sick.
So, what they did so good, is they copied, took what... They took what Ford was doing. They brought the... made a bigger windshield and had that fill in that whole space. So, it's more of a fastback design. They called it the Charger 500. It performed a lot better, but they had to go that one step further. You know, it's Chrysler. They have a rocket science division.
Yeah.
Project
Paperclip.
Operation Paperclip. They brought in NASA, you know, Germany. They had a lot of smart individuals over there, Nazi scientists. They brought them over here, Wernher von Braun, to help develop America's space program. None of those people were involved with the Charger Daytona. That'd be an incredible waste of resources by the U.S. government. But, Chrysler did have a rocket division, and they did have aerodynamicists that helped out with the shaping of the nose that we will now talk about.
Cool. Going along with the extreme reaction to the Torino Talladega, Dodge welded on a rear wing so big it looked cartoonish.
Yeah, that's putting it lightly.
They also massaged the whole car into an aerodynamic blob and added hood scoops that would allow for proper front tire clearance.
And also, I think, like, air evacuation from the wheel wells.
Yes.
To create less pressure in there. I mean, blob is not the right word I would use. I would say,
but for the time,
missile. Yeah. I mean, this is like one of the sickest looking cars ever. I love the Daytona. The Superbird.
Not so much.
Not so much.
Why? Because of the blue?
It's uglier. They're different noses and different wings.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think the Plymouth car, the Superbird, just looks a little. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I think the Daytona is, that's what I would get.
I feel you on that. All of these changes boosted the Daytona's performance so much that on March 24th, 1970, at Talladega Super Speedway, Buddy Baker climbed behind the wheel of his blue Daytona and shattered the NASCAR speed record handily.
I'm going feral over here.
This is your favorite car?
Because I love this car so much. It's, you know, every, I feel like on this channel, doing this job, we drive so many different cars.
Yeah.
We research a lot, talk about so many different cars. Uh-huh. I'm like, yeah, everything's pretty cool. But like this episode, specifically this one, is reminding me I love Dodge so much. I need a Daytona someday. I mean, those are so expensive, but you could build a clone.
You could absolutely build a clone.
Build a clone. Yeah. I would do that. Do you enjoy those like modern Charger Daytona conversions?
No, the problem with those, they look like,
they're so goofy.
They look like Pixar characters because they're so like fat and like exaggerated compared to the real thing. Mm-hmm. I see what people are doing. You know, it's not for me, but
the Daytona is better looking than the Superbird. I'm looking at a comparison right now.
Well, yeah. So with the Daytona, the wing specifically on the back is further back on the trunk. I think that looks cooler. And then the nose just has a more utilitarian shape, whereas it looks like with the Plymouth car. If I remember correctly, Plymouth, they wanted their own wing car for Richard Petty.
Yeah.
But they also wanted it to, it wasn't selling very well, the Charger Daytona, because it's just such a race car. So they wanted something that looked a little better to the consumer's eyes. And so they took those, the nose and the wing, and styled it more. And I think they went in the wrong direction. I don't like the look.
I wonder why they went with the wing so high up.
So
to go above the roof, because the roof was still causing turbulence behind the fastback. So it had to reach into clear air, or clean air, rather.
That makes sense.
By 1970, as muscle car sales declined due to the Clean Air Act and other external factors like the gas crisis, which hadn't fully hit yet, Dodge still offered a dealership full of muscle cars. The Charger RT and Challenger RT boasted a 425 horsepower 426 Hemi.
See, that's my perfect. If it makes as much horsepower as the displacement,
the number in
it's so satisfying.
I got to drive Jay Leno's Challenger RT. Oh, that was the best day ever. Mm-mm. The Coronet had the same motor, but was offered in a limited Super B badging that made a very popular return in the 2010s. Super B, pretty cool. I love the graphics on those.
Yeah.
By 1971 and 72, sales had slumped and the gas crisis was coming into full swing. If the Clean Air Act was a glancing jab, the 1973 oil embargo was a knockout uppercut to muscle cars. Not because the American public didn't want them, but because the manufacturers were forced into a game of emissions regulations and performance limitations that would last more than 20 years. Also, I mean, gas, you could only buy like 2 gallons at a time, 3 gallons at a time during that time. So, I mean, if you had these cars literally get like 8 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, they suck.
So that would probably keep you from buying one too off the lot. Dodge took a leap and shifted their muscle bad boy from a big block racer to a personal luxury vehicle. The manufacturer axed all the special models and only offered the Charger SE, or Special Edition. That special V8 made an alarmingly low 190 horsepower, setting the performance ratings back almost 30 years. So, personal luxury vehicle, that was kind of like a segment started and perfected by the Ford Thunderbird. It's like not a full-on luxury or sports car, but still very nice on the inside and had pretty decent performance.
I didn't know that about the Thunderbird.
They shifted the Charger to kind of fit that niche. Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you know what? I have to commute on the high, you know, do I live?
It's called a Grand Tourer.
similar.
Not a sedan. Think, right?
Yeah, Grand Tour, which is a very like European British kind of idea, mm-hmm. but for straight American roads,
right,
and interstates, and like saying, oh, you know, I gotta do my commute from is Waukesha close to Milwaukee?
Waukesha. Yeah, it's 20 minutes.
Yeah, I got to do my commute from Waukesha to Milwaukee.
How do you know about Waukesha?
Because my sister lives around there.
Really? Mm-hmm. I used to go to a head shop in Waukesha and get, you know, foot bags and posters.
Cool. Okay, so like I said, performance went back 30 years, but the interior was really nice. The inside features what was essentially a lounge chair instead of a bucket seat. The carpets were approaching shag territory, and the ride could only be described as plush and cloud-like. In 1968, Dodge had sold just short of 100,000 Chargers. Cut to 1975, and the Charger redesign sold just under 30,000 units, 70% less than before. But at a time when auto manufacturers were facing an oil apocalypse and having to rethink their entire go-fast formula, 30,000 units is still pretty good. Albeit, the performance numbers were depressing gearheads who were clinging on to their decade-old muscle cars for dear life. The 180-horsepower Charger with wire wheel covers wasn't bringing any joy, even when the Corvette that year was putting out the exact same horsepower and weighed almost 500 pounds more, but would do 0 to 60 in 6.8 seconds. The 1977 Charger ambled from 0 to 60 in 11.5, twice as long as the base V6 Charger takes in 2024.
You know what's crazy is, he says, like, clutching, like, clinging onto their 10-year-old muscle cars. Like, at the time, 10 years was so long for a car.
I mean, I do still think about that. It's like, if there's another grass crisis, if there's...
never again, dude.
Not in California.
If there is another gas crisis, like, I'm thinking about my truck. That thing, it goes between maybe, like, 16 or, like, 22, depending
that's
on, like,
my truck.
I get 12, so...
Yeah.
And that's a good day.
Yeah. You got a heavy tray.
I'm just saying, like, if there was like a limit on gas you could buy, like, it'd be pretty quick before I was like, start riding my bike to work, you know?
I'd be in a great position.
Yeah.
I filled up the RAV4 twice since we bought it in June.
That's incredible.
Whoa.
Yeah. Wow. 600 mile range when, you know, you fill it up and you charge
that's
it up.
So
yeah.
Crazy. Wow.
It's pretty great.
Rid of the Audi?
No, I still have the Audi too. But
so you got rid of her Audi.
Yeah, she had the same one.
Probably should have got rid of yours and kept hers.
I know, but mine, I was in a weird position where I still owed more than it was worth.
So, I hate that.
I do. It sucks, dude. Because now when I paid off, it's going to be worth like 20% of what I paid for it.
Right. Yeah.
So during this era, Dodge was still pushing limits and was on the cusp of releasing the fastest production vehicle in the late 1970s, and it wasn't even a car.
What?
Yeah.
You're going back to trucks?
Going back to trucks?
So check out, stay tuned next week for that whole story. American automakers were forced to introduce smaller and weaker cars that were more fuel efficient to compete with the great Japanese cars that were coming in to fill the gap, as well as meet fuel requirements set by Congress trying to balance an oil war as well as smoggy skies. By 1978, American automakers had been destroyed by 30 to 40% drops in sales, while Toyota had boosted their sales by 20%. From 1979 to 1980, Japanese automakers rolled more cars off the line than Detroit managed to, as their share of American auto sales went from 9% by the mid-1970s to 21% at the dawn of the 1980s.
Could you imagine just like dropping bombs on a country and then they just take over your market afterwards?
I mean, that was part of the reason why, like, two factors. Like, you're right. Like, the war, like, obviously... that World War II and people's experiences over there really like shaped their perception of Japan as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And like kind of was like, you know what? Like, we don't need to worry about them. It was kind of like hubris. And also American like protectionism of like giving preferential treatment to the American automakers. And then all of a sudden when it comes time, like when a national emergency hits, like the gas crisis, all of a sudden they're f***ed.
Yeah.
You know, like, they sat on their ass and took everything for granted. And then when it counted most, all that hubris bit them right in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
But then Reagan helped them out a lot with like, import.
And then it came around again. Yeah. I mean, that's why Lexus and Acura and all the luxury Japanese brands exist, is because we've talked about that before, but they limited how many Japanese cars could come into the country. So they had to get creative.
So they give Americans more time to catch up.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, I think right now we're kind of in a similar deal now.
This is all very familiar.
Like the American automakers were all relying on big ass trucks that have huge profit margins.
Oh yeah.
And we're putting tariffs on another Asian country to keep them from importing their cars that are pretty good.
Because people refuse to change for a really long time.
Something's going
to
go wrong. Something's going to happen, and we're going to be right back to where we are.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Don't say I didn't warn you.
political imbalances.
It's just hubris, man. It's just like, we don't learn from our mistakes. All the old heads that were at these companies and in government during this time, they are long retired, maybe probably dead. And
their kids are doing the same mistakes.
Yeah, the people. Exactly, Justin. So a recession took hold.
Yeah.
And Chrysler and Dodge by default were hit incredibly hard by new fuel standards and less spending by U.S. buyers. Chrysler shook up their upper management teams, bringing in a new perspective and younger teams. And in April of 1978, Chrysler reported the greatest quarterly loss in its more than 50-year history.
Damn.
Later that year, the president of Chrysler and the young blood they'd hoped would save the day, one Eugene Cafiero, resigned and moved on to the executive team at DeLorean. This created a power vacuum that could only be filled by a capable, innovative young man with a deep understanding of the industry.
Nolan J. Sykes. Now,
this man was named Lee Iacocca, the savior of Chrysler.
Lee Iacocca.
And we'll talk about him next time on Past Gas.
Yeah. So,
that's a good cliffhanger right there, dude.
Cooking. Dodge had a great run in the 60s, early 70s.
When power mattered.
Yeah.
And racing.
I mean, these guys were probably doing amphetamines.
Quaaludes.
They were doing stuff in the board. I mean, Chrysler.
Drinking whiskey at lunch.
Something we didn't really
steaks.
Touch in this episode. One of my favorite things about Chrysler is that like Ford and Chevy were really like Chrysler's part of the big three, clearly, but like, let's be honest, there's really a bigger two, which is Ford and Chevy.
Yeah.
And Chrysler was just doing anything they could at the time attract attention to their brand. Big power with the Hemi. The styling of this time, the 60s with Chrysler across all their brands was just fucking bananas. You look at like a similar car from Chevy or Ford at the same time, they are so boring by comparison. Chrysler, that's why Chrysler today, also with the help of Dave Freiberger and Roadkill, I think that's why they are so popular and so expensive today. Is those the Cuda, your Challenger, like the styling of those cars is unlike anything else that any other brand was putting out at the time.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were crazy. They were doing whatever to get noticed. And I think that's why they've stood the test of time and why I think the Challenger today, the new one, it came out like so long ago now. The current Challenger, I think, is still a very good looking car and very popular as a result.
Everything they did during that period was so iconic, and it just had lasting, rippling effects to everything nowadays.
Absolutely. So, some closing questions. How does legendary brand survive the malaise era? How do they bounce back? How is Carroll Shelby involved? We're going to find out next week in part 3 of Dodge. We're going to get to know Lee Iacocca. Joe, we have some listener mail.
This is from Nassim. Hey guys, my name is Nassim A. I am 12 years old and I am from Montreal.
Montreal.
I absolutely love the podcast and you guys always make me laugh. Thank you, Nassim.
Thanks, dude.
The subjects are always so interesting and you guys find a way to make it hilarious. Now I want to show you a Lego Turbo I made.
Thank you so much. Oh, hell
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
That's sick. You got the little turbine in there.
Nice. You got the hot and cold side.
Heck yeah.
Dude, this kid understands turbos.
Does it work?
How much boost?
That's awesome, dude.
That's awesome, Nassim. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your letter. Tune in next week for the finale of the Dodge three-part series. Where are they today? I think that's a bad question. We know where they are.
They're
at takeovers.
They're doing better than Nissan.
Yeah, it's true. Justin, thank you so much for being on.
Of course.
Follow Justin at Justin Freeman. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes if you'd like. Big thanks to our crew. We got Audrey. We got John.
Yeah. And our writer this week, Jacob Desjardins. You're awesome.
Go watch the Hilo finale. Go watch the Ranger finale.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and if you have any road trip snacks for Road and Snack, send them to Donut Media, P.O. Box 84, Inglewood, California, 90306.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.